Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Jen Emily. Today we'll be talking about the horrible tragedy in Brynbrook, where a mother is accused of killing her two young daughters. We'll also chat about the murder of a man who found himself in the spotlight after he and a stranger had sex on a Ferris wheel the day of his wedding, and a shooting that involved a love triangle. My co-hosts today are Naheed Wajwani and Claire Bowler. Joining us in the studio today is State District Judge Brandon Birmingham. He's a felony court judge in Dallas County, and before that, a prosecutor. We'll talk about his time on the bench, including a recent guitar jam where he played Led Zeppelin and Justin Bieber for some visiting students. Editorial writer Mike Hashimoto will end our show in our usual way with his latest Hashing It Out segment. So, Claire, tell us about what's happened in Brynbrook with the mother who's accused of killing her children.
So last Thursday, a world-renowned pianist, Vadim Kolodenko, arrived at his estranged wife's home to pick up his young daughters for school. He arrives and sees his estranged wife bleeding on the floor with stab wounds and his two young daughters dead, cold in their beds. Police have recently said that Saigonkova stabbed herself multiple times after smothering and suffocating her young daughters. One was 5 years old, one was only a year old. From what we understand, the morning before these daughters were found killed in their beds, their mother had visited a mental health facility. Police also found an empty bottle of prescription meds prescribed to Saigonkova. It was an antipsychotic medication often used to treat bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. Police also found bloodied rags in her car parked in the garage, and also rags stuffed into the exhaust pipe of the vehicle. So the affidavit seems to indicate that Saigonkova may have perhaps tried multiple ways to kill herself after killing her daughters.
And so what do we know about the mother's visit to the mental health facility? Do we know why she was there or anything about that visit, or is that still something that's unknown, at least to the public?
We don't know much. What we really know is that she did visit a mental health facility in Fort Worth on Wednesday. At that time, a babysitter was at the home watching the two young girls. This is a babysitter who had worked frequently and often with the family. And according to the babysitter, it was a routine kind of day. She wasn't sure why Saigonkova was at the mental health facility. But considering the medications that were prescribed to her, it seems to indicate that she has had some past with mental health problems, and her family has also validated that as well.
There's still a lot to find out about what happened here, and we've seen over the years in the country and in Dallas County and in North Texas, other mothers who have killed their children. They're suffering from postpartum psychosis. This isn't postpartum depression, which, you know, often happens after somebody has a baby, but this is a psychosis where women like Dina Schlosser in Plano are, who cut off her baby's arms, 10-month-old Maggie, because, you know, she thought, you know, she was hearing the devil. She heard voices from the TV. She saw blood running down the streets. And, of course, Andrea Yates in Houston, who drowned all of her children. She was also suffering from psychosis. But we also have women like Darlie Routier, who is on death row. She was convicted of stabbing one of her children, but was also accused but not tried in the other. And it was something completely different. Both Andrea Yates and Dina Schlosser were eventually found not guilty by reason of insanity and were sent to mental health facilities.
So, Claire, in this case, there are different paths that these mothers can take. And it seems like police haven't really said what could have led up directly to, you know, these daughters being killed. But what do we know about the relationship between the mom and the dad leading up to this?
So we know a few things. We know that this couple has been separated since the fall, and we know that they are currently going through a divorce. We are not sure why. We don't really know what led up to this point in their relationship, but we do know that Kolodenko has been living elsewhere and often makes trips back over to Europe, but we're not sure what his involvement has been like with the family or with the girls. But we do know that their relationship has been experiencing difficulties. And Sofia Tsigankova's sister, Anna Tsigankova, is actually a famous Russian ballet dancer who has expressed concern for her sister in the past over the difficulty that she's been experiencing with this divorce and also with her mental health problems.
Claire, you went into the house yesterday that this family lived in. What did you see when you got there?
So it was a brief moment that I was able to step inside the home, but there were what seemed to be perhaps family and friends there gathering up all the personal belongings, which included, you know, the small shoes of Michaela and Nika and their clothing and toys and all the personal belongings there. So it seems as though, you know, the family and friends are trying to pick up the pieces and find out what to do from here. And I know that Kolodenko has been extremely distraught. At the girls' memorial, he wasn't able to speak, but he did play a piece on the piano in memory of his daughters.
Nahid, talk to us a little bit about this man who became famous after something happened on a Ferris wheel, or maybe notorious is a better word.
It's also possible whatever happened on the Ferris wheel may have contributed to his death. But basically, this is a story about Philip Frank Panzeka III. He was arrested last month after he had sex with a New York woman aboard a Las Vegas's high roller, which is one of it claims to be one of the world's tallest Ferris wheels, a 30-minute ride, hundreds of feet in the air. Later, after these two people were arrested, there are a lot of news reports that they didn't know each other, and that actually Philip Panzeka had gone to Vegas to get married. And the day of his wedding, he got in an argument with his fiancée after he believed that she had gotten pregnant with another man's baby. So instead of exchanging vows and getting married, he ended up partying, drinking, gambling, and met this New Yorker that he, I guess, ended up having sex with on a high roller in a public place. It's all in, like, glass encased, so people definitely saw what was happening. But after this incident, Panzeka was arrested. His fiance bailed him out, said, you know, we've reconciled. We're going to go through with our marriage later on. And so things seemed to be doing okay. He got a lot of fame out of it, obviously. You know how the news media does. We love these types of stories sometimes. But it seems like he got at least $4,000 from Inside Edition to do interviews. By the way, we at the Dallas Morning News don't pay our sources to talk to us, but he did get $4,000 from Inside Edition, which is pretty typical for national outlets. So in terms of paying people to talk to you. And so I guess the day before he died, which was Saturday, his fiance told a TV station that he had maybe been bragging about the money that he got, and that may have tipped a few people off who may have been looking to you know, cash in on his luck, I guess. But so Friday night, I guess, is when he was telling people that he had made money off of this interview. And then Saturday night, he actually went to a strip club in Houston. This is a Houston man. He's actually from Houston. He drove to a strip club in Houston where his fiance works, and had picked her up. And I guess two people who it seems like they knew each other ended up taking a ride with Misty Bazant, the fiance, and Panzeka to a couple of clubs in the area. And as they were driving to an after-hours club, authorities say that Bryant Christopher Watts, who's 29, and Aaron Jones, who's 31, shot Panzeka after one of them told him to, quote, come clean, and drove away in his fiance's 2016 nice SUV, which had her Coach purse. It also had $1,000 she'd made at the strip club that night, and also the $4,000 check from Inside Edition.
So do the police believe that there is anybody else involved? Do they think they have everyone? What's going on? Is this closed?
It doesn't seem like it's a closed case. The two people that have been accused of being involved, Watts, for example, seems to have a record in Dallas County, including bribery, convictions of bribery, aggravated assault. There are news reports that Jones also is from the Dallas area. So it seems like this is still under investigation. Police were pretty quick to put out news releases about this, especially from Houston, because now these two men are charged with capital murder. And they were found actually in central Texas, miles and miles away from Houston, where this happened, shortly after the shooting in Panzeca's fiance's car. So it seems as though these are the two people that were at least there the night of. But who knows? I mean, there could be more people that may have been involved. And I'm sure that's something that we'll be looking out for.
So the moral of this story is, what happens in Vegas doesn't really stay in Vegas, and sometimes it can kill you.
Yes, it seems as though that is the moral of this thing.
So this week in Kaufman, there were reports of an active shooter. For me, it put me on high alert because the last time there was a big shooting in Kaufman, a prosecutor and then the district attorney and his wife were killed. Of course, that man and his wife, Eric Williams and Kim Williams, were arrested and now in prison, but it was hard not to think about it. And it turned out to be something completely different than what I thought it was, which, of course, is the case. And Claire, you went out to Kaufman, right?
I did. So police received calls of an active shooter at a Walmart in Kaufman around 10 a.m. on Tuesday, and they arrived to find a man had shot himself in the head after shooting a Walmart employee in the garden center multiple times. It turns out that these two men knew each other from Henderson County, where they live. They were neighbors. And John Morgan was the employee, 59-year-old, who worked for Walmart. And Donald Coleman, 55, was his angry neighbor who came to the Walmart to what police say surprise attack and shoot Coleman.
They were arguing they'd been fighting over a woman, right?
Yes. Police say that that's true. Police were still looking into the motive of this shooting, but they said it was pretty obvious they had some problems in the past that stemmed from Henderson County. So Coleman, police say, had an estranged wife who was dating Morgan, the victim, who was also their neighbor. So police had been notified of some rifts between these three people before. For example, earlier this year, Gun Barrel City police were looking for Coleman because they had been told that he had pistol whipped a 50-year-old woman who police now believe was his wife and threatened to kill her because she'd gone out with a friend one night. So we don't know if the friend that was referenced in the gun barrel shooting, the gun barrel incident, was actually Morgan, but police are still looking into that and trying to determine how far back these two people may have been having disagreements and problems.
And the neighbor who's accused of the shooting survived and is hospitalized.
Yes, he. This morning we heard from police that he was still in critical condition. His condition had stabilized since the shooting, but he's still listed in critical condition, and police plan on charging him with murder. And so this just seems like one of those ones where police just don't know why he decided to come to this Walmart specifically on the day that he did. But, you know, there were a lot of people there when it happened, and, you know, police were trying to offer them some support because, for example, there's a man who'd been standing. This was in the garden center at Walmart, which, you know, it could be a busy place in the daytime. But there are a lot of people who saw this shooting, and especially one man was standing right next to Morgan when he was shot and saw it all go down. So it'll be interesting to see what that man has to say to police and how that determines the investigation.
And I never lied to admit that I was wrong. And I've been so caught up in my talk.
Now joining us in the studio is State District Judge Brandon Birmingham. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So that's you on the guitar.
That is me. I'm a believer. As they say.
Thanks to your daughter.
Thanks to my daughter, yeah. She had some friends over, and we were on our way out to dinner the other night and for her birthday, and that song came on, and it's a catchy song. And anybody who says it's not is a liar, and they like that song. I know it. And so I learned it for the girls and you know, had some fun with it, and lo and behold, a couple days later, it paid off in the courtroom.
So you keep a guitar in your chambers all the time.
I do, yeah. I put it in there a couple months ago, you know, waiting on jury verdicts and things like that. I have an app on my phone where I can plug it in and I can put my headphones on and nobody knows that I'm playing. But it's a good way to pass some of the time.
So you originally got the guitar out to play these students, high school students. They go to Lincoln High School at DISD.
Mm-hmm.
to play them some Led Zeppelin because they didn't even know who that was.
Right. There was a friend of mine came and brought them and asked if they could come watch a court proceeding. And I love that. I have students come from all kinds of schools. I've had students from Turner, where I went to school. I've had some from Duncanville. So I bring them up and start talking to them and ask them, you know, a little bit about themselves, just who they are and what they do. And they're asking me questions about this and that and how I became a judge and all of that. And I asked them what they like to do besides that. And there was three or four of them said that they were singers. And so we were just talking about what kind of music they like and what kind of music that I liked. And I asked them if they had ever heard of Led Zeppelin. They said no. And I said, do y'all ever think that a judge has a guitar in his chambers? And so we brought it out, and I started playing a little bit for him. And then I told them that I had a guilty pleasure song, and they weren't allowed to tell anybody about it, but that if they knew how to sing that song, Justin Bieber's song. And so lo and behold, they did, and the song broke out. It was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. I think it kind of made the rounds of the courthouse, and you had Justice Willett on the Supreme Court of Texas weighing in and saying,
"Well, he was calling me out on some stuff. He said, first of all, why would, you know, only George Strait is allowed to be played at the Supreme Court, you know? And I think that's all right. I love George Strait. I love all kinds of music. I've heard some people ask me why I didn't play like Stevie Ray Vaughan or something like that, and basically I'm not good enough to play Stevie Ray Vaughan. And there's, you know, some other things like that. But the other deal is that there was a lawyer who practices down there, Brad Lawler's his name, and he came up with this motion, a motion that he filed with me to never allow the court to sing a Justin Bieber song ever again. And I thought that was really kind of funny, and that's kind of the has caught on a little bit.
And Brad has a very good sense of humor, as do you. And
yes,
just, you know, this whole guitar and the fake uproar over Justin Bieber was a nice break from the murder and mayhem that we all experience all too often down there.
It's true. And you know, it's funny because in that whole exchange with the Lincoln students, you know, that took about 5 minutes. And that was in the middle of docket call. Thursdays and Fridays are always busy. You never know what's going to happen. Earlier that morning, I had to unfortunately, I had to send somebody to prison for a while. There was another, about an hour before that, I had to sort of sort out where kids were going to go between these couples. And then, lo and behold, we have this sort of light moment, and that was a lot of fun. And hopefully the students had fun. I mean, I made that same trip down to Frank Crowley when I was their age. And I sat in on a murder trial, watched a little bit of it. I thought at the time that, you know, somebody who's a judge and a lawyer, it's unattainable to do something like that. So whenever I get the chance, I like to talk to the kids and tell them that, you know, hey, I was an average student, you know, just a regular old high school kid. And now, if you go to school and finish out and do good, you can be a judge.
More seriously, the state's commission that examines exonerations met this week in Austin. And you've been paying close attention to that. And part of the reason, I would think, is we've had a lot of exonerations in Dallas County.
Right.
Unlike other places, we kept the DNA evidence that has allowed the exonerations to happen. And since then, we've also had some non-DNA exonerations.
Right. Yeah, absolutely right.
As a judge, what could the commission do that would help you do your job? What would you like to see?
Well, there is policies that I think have those that are involved in the prosecution and defense of cases and the judges that oversee them would tell you need to happen. One of the things that they're mulling over right now in the Exoneration Review Commission is whether to require the videotaping of all interrogations. Right now, that's not necessarily a condition to admissibility. I mean, there are certain rules that apply, but it doesn't have to be video and audio tape. They're talking about whether to do that. There's pros and cons about it. You know, in Dallas County, we, by and large, I think every police department does do that. So that's not something that necessarily touches us. But we're learning from those DNA cases, those exonerations that have happened before, we're learning about why that happened. And one of the cases in particular was Christopher Scott's case. That was a non-DNA exoneration that happened here. Detective Ken Penrod and the Conviction Integrity Unit did a lot of work on that. And he presented his case, and the commission is going to look at that and see what it is. We know that Brady violations happen. We know that evidence is withheld. We know that sometimes the eyewitness identification is wrong, and there's been some things in the past to address that. But now we're trying to move forward and see if we can't streamline and achieve some other ends as far as admissible evidence that can help achieve justice in those cases, all of those cases.
And you mentioned Christopher Scott. He mm-hmm. runs House of Renewed Hope to investigate potential other wrongful convictions. And he's actually been on the podcast twice.
Has
so
he really?
You need to come back one more time so you can try to tie Chris.
That sounds good.
Yeah. So we've known each other a long time, and this whole time I've been struggling to not call you Brandon, to call you Judge, because we've known each other almost 10 years, and most of that time you were not on the bench, and so I called you Brandon. But I've been trying to very carefully to call you Judge Birmingham.
Well, I was a little upset when you didn't stand up when I walked in, but that's okay, well, I guess.
Do you remember how we met?
I do. Willie Atkins. Yeah. The man who was filming himself with all those underage boys, and we had that trial. It was one of the first trials that you were involved in, I think, as a reporter.
It was.
Down here. And boy, oh boy, that was a scary guy, wasn't it? He was filming himself with all these underage boys, and it turns out that he had unprotected sex with 131 people, potentially spreading the AIDS virus. We found out he had AIDS and during the investigation of that case, and boy, that was something else.
That was some uncomfortable moments in the courtroom because we had to watch some of those videos.
Right, we did.
Poor jury.
Poor jury, poor Brandon. I had to watch every single one of those. I mean, you know, but no, the jurors were great, you know, and I think, you know, one of the things that I'd, you know, like to say is that, you know, those jurors did a good job. My experience with jurors is that once they actually do serve on the jury, it's a very good experience for them. I would encourage everybody to serve on the juries when they get a chance to do that. I know you've had some experience with jurors in the family, but you know, the attendance in Dallas County for jury service is about 1 in 4, and that's just atrocious. That's awful.
Before we got to know each other very well,
yes,
my husband was a juror on one of your cases.
He was.
And we knew each other, but not well, and we quit talking. We didn't speak.
Right.
I didn't talk to the judge. I didn't talk to the defense attorneys. I didn't talk to the other prosecutor, Mindy Souter,
mm-hmm.
and they had another reporter cover the case.
Right.
It was very weird. I believe it was, we have to take Jen's husband or we're not going to trial. That today we'd have to put it off for months or something like that. I don't remember for certain.
Well, I think people were surprised that I would put a journalist's husband on a jury.
Who's actually a journalist himself. He works at the
right,
Dallas Morning News.
A journalist, right.
Yes.
But he did wonderful. And I mean, I think, you know, obviously that was, all the cases are important, but I think he had ultimately a positive experience from that. I don't know.
Yeah, he enjoyed it. He learned a lot. And, you know, it was a case where there was DNA evidence.
Right.
So it was an interesting being for him, I think, being part of a jury because he sat in the courtroom as a reporter and, you know, had an experience that I will probably never have in being part of a jury.
That's right.
Unless I move far away and I'm no longer a reporter and I don't know anybody.
Yeah, so. I think I'm kind of the same way. There's no way I'm ever going to be on a jury. I don't know. I doubt it. I'd like to, but we'll see.
Maybe a long time from now.
Maybe so.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be here. And, I got to say this, too. I was told to bring my guitar. I didn't really think you were serious about that. But anytime you want to have somebody sing a song, I'll come and play for them.
Well, I will pass the word.
That is on the record now.
Good. Bring it on. See, look.
You'll hear the latest Hashing It Out in just a moment. Stay tuned to DallasNews.com for more coverage of criminal justice issues. Remember to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crimecast. Judge Birmingham is at Judge Birmingham. Thanks to our sound engineer, Tommy Noel, for Naheed Rajwani and Claire Bowler, I'm Jen Emily. We hope you stay safe out there. Now, we drop the mic.
Terrorism is never too far from our thoughts. The murders in Brussels this week were a harsh reminder. Here in North Texas, we haven't forgotten last year's aborted attack in Garland by two Islamic State sympathizers. Combating terror in a free country like ours often comes down to the state's demands versus individual liberties. As much as we might like, the answer is rarely absolute. This is where we find the greater good argument. It recognizes that a particular policy or law might not be your first choice, but many more benefit than not, therefore the greater good is served. A current, for instance, is the FBI demanding that tech giant Apple build a key to skirt its iPhone encryption. The FBI insisted repeatedly that it could not do this on its own. This left it blocked from accessing an iPhone used by a terrorist who killed 14 people in San Bernardino, California. Except that apparently was not accurate. Just this week, on the eve of a critical hearing, the FBI slammed on the brakes in reverse field, Shazam, it might have found a way after all that did not involve Apple. The FBI is a government, and greater good means something. Our faith in that is diminished when the government shows it's not as trustworthy as we might have hoped.